impeachment inquiry has gone public with two central questions. Did President Trump withhold military aid in exchange for a favor? And how bad is that?
Is this what Americans should now expect from their president? If this is not impeachable conduct, what is?
Also, Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is visiting the White House today. We look at how the strongman has transformed his country.
Turkey was a country that treated people such as Erdogan, who wanted to wear religion on their sleeve, as second-class citizens.
And researchers in Australia calculated how national parks help keep us mentally fit. They do, and the medical payback is huge. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is on.
Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
The first day of public hearings in the impeachment inquiry of President Trump began today. Democratic House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff started off the hearing with a central question. Did President Trump withhold military aid from Ukraine to force an investigation into his political rival Joe Biden?
Is this what Americans should now expect from their president? If this is not impeachable conduct, what is?
On the other side of the aisle, Republican Devin Nunes called the hearing a theatrical performance.
It seems you agreed, witting or unwittingly, to participate in a drama. But the main performance, the Russia hoax, has ended, and you've been cast in the low-rent Ukrainian sequel.
Nunes was addressing the two witnesses before the House today, Bill Taylor, the top American diplomat in Ukraine, and George Kent, a senior State Department official in charge of Ukraine policy. Before the witnesses could be heard, Republican Jim Jordan interrupted Chairman Schiff and asked for the whistleblower's identity. The whistleblower, of course, being the person who first brought the phone call between President Trump and Ukraine's president to light. Here's Jordan.
Mr. Chairman, do you anticipate when we would vote
on that? What purpose does Mr. Jordan seek recognition?
Just to ask a clarifying question, do you anticipate when we might vote on the ability to have the whistleblower in front of us, something you, of the 435 members of Congress, you are the only member who knows who that individual is, and your staff is the only staff of any member of Congress who's had a chance to talk with that individual. We would like that opportunity. When might that happen in this proceeding today?
Schiff said he does not know the identity of the whistleblower and was determined to protect their identity. As for the testimonies, Ambassador Taylor had some strong words about withholding aid money from Ukraine in exchange for political favors.
As the committee is aware, I wrote that withholding security assistance in exchange for help with a domestic political campaign in the United States would be crazy. I believed that then, and I believe it now.
Taylor went on to mention how unusual communication had been between the White House and Kyiv.
I found a confusing and unusual arrangement for making U.S. policy toward Ukraine. There appeared to be two channels of U.S. policymaking and implementation, one regular and one highly irregular.
We'll hear more about those channels throughout the show today, but first, what's at stake? A lot. Ambassador Daniel Freed retired from the U.S. Foreign Service in 2017 after four decades. He's now a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council. So Adam Schiff, in his opening remarks, said the future of the presidency itself is at stake.
Our answer to these questions will affect not only the future of this presidency, but the future of the presidency itself, and what kind of conduct or misconduct the American people may come to expect from their commander-in-chief.
And yet, Ambassador Freed, many Americans on both sides of the political spectrum have long seen all politicians as kind of suspicious characters. So how is the conduct of this president different?
The central issue of the current impeachment debate is what the responsibility should be for a president who abandons his public duties for the sake of his private interests. That's what this is about. The issue is not a policy disagreement over President Trump's course of action one way or another. The issue is whether he was pursuing a private political agenda, sacrificing public policy, including his own declared public policy of support for Ukraine.
So let me ask you the question many of the president's supporters are wondering about. Yes, Trump's conduct is unorthodox, but how does this rise to the level of impeachment? The Constitution does require high crimes and misdemeanors, is what he allegedly did, criminal.
Well, the Constitution mentions bribery, and arguably, allegedly, President Trump was soliciting a bribe from Ukrainian President Zelensky. That is, he was telling Zelensky that he, Trump, would withhold both needed military aid and a visit to Washington unless Zelensky acted on behalf of the president's private interests. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but a bribe involves the receipt of a favor or money or a service of a private nature in exchange for performance of a public act. That is, you give me money, I give you a license. You give me some dirt on my opponents, and I release money which you need for the defense of your country. Now, I am not making that accusation myself. I'm not a lawyer, but that is the nature of the issue. Arguably, the president's conduct rises to that level of bad.
So, Ambassador, the outcome of this impeachment inquiry is by no means certain since the Republicans control the Senate, where any trial would take place. But regardless of the outcome, what consequences have there already been? And let's start with America's standing in the world.
I was in Ukraine in October, and Ukrainians asked me whether they could still trust the United States. After 40 years of being an American diplomat, that was a painful question, especially because I understood the basis for it.
And that evaporating trust in the U.S., I mean, what about consequences for the—
Well, I wouldn't say it's evaporating.
No.
They questioned it, and I did my best to assure them that whatever the president's views, there were Americans, Republicans and Democrats, right, center, left, who supported Ukraine's aspirations. And they should work with those Americans and understand that every country, including my own, has difficult politics. I did not enjoy conveying a message of that kind, but I felt I had to give them a measure of reasonable hope based on reality.
Ambassador Fried, you personally know Bill Taylor, George Kent, Marie Yovanovitch, Kurt Volker, many other players in this whole drama. You worked with them for years.
We all know each other.
Yeah.
We've all worked together for years.
How do they feel about being dragged into this scandal?
Well, I won't characterize their feelings except to say that I am proud of my colleagues for standing up and speaking out. Not voluntarily. They did so because they were subpoenaed. But I think that all of them were trying in their own way to find a way through a mess which was created because of, frankly, the president's pursuit of his private political interests at the expense of his public duties.
Ambassador Daniel Fried, a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
We'll be going to Ukraine for the view from Kyiv later. Another major international story is playing out in Washington today. President Trump meeting with the president of Turkey at the White House. Recep Tayyip Erdogan is a controversial leader, and Trump's invitation to him was a controversial move. Turkey is an ally and member of NATO, but Erdogan has threatened those relationships with two recent moves. First, buying a Russian air defense system, and second, sending Turkish forces across the Syrian border to root out Kurdish militias who were until recently American partners. Our BBC colleague Mike Thompson in Istanbul reports on the rift between Turkey and its allies.
Tensions with the West came to a head last month with the Turkish incursion into neighboring northern Syria, where, with Russian assistance, it's driven out US-backed YPG Kurdish forces.
Making a cooperation with Russians was left the only option to have real results in Syria, to penetrate into Syrian land, to create a safe, secure zone for Turkey. This was the only option.
Osman Sert, research director of the Ankara Institute think tank, insists that Washington had clearly signalled its approval for this, despite later denials.
The American President Trump tweeted that Turkey will make an operation and we won't stop it. And if it is not a green light, what is a green light? Okay?
A unemployment rising and the economy on the slide, this street busker's maudlin song seems to mirror the mood of many here.
Now, one out of six people are looking for jobs.
And economist Ibrahim Turhan fears that new sanctions against Ankara, proposed by the US House of Representatives, could further cement Turkey's ties with Russia.
Turkey is dependent in terms of energy to Russia. Turkey is becoming more and more depending in terms of its defense industry to Russia. And especially after what happened in Syria, Turkey will become again dependent to Russia in terms of its foreign policy. Altogether, do not draw a promising picture, I am afraid.
Up a steep flight of stairs off a busy Istanbul street, I meet Ünal Çerikus, a former Turkish ambassador, now deputy chair of the opposition Republican People's Party. Çerikus says he understands why the West is so concerned about his country's purchase of Russia's S-400 missile defence system. It's incompatible with NATO systems and puts the organisation at risk.
It creates a kind of a security threat to the whole NATO system because their radars will be receiving and intercepting all kinds of NATO activities in the neighbourhood.
Is that something that would be receivable by the Russians because it's their own system?
Yes, and there will be some serious effort of espionage or intelligence gathering.
Ever since Recep Tayyip Erdogan became Turkey's prime minister in 2003, Islam has played an increasingly prominent role in life here. And some believe that this fact, even though Turkey remains officially a secular state, helps explain why it's still being shunned by the EU.
This coincides with the rise of Islamophobia, terrorist attacks of the jihadists, and with the rise of migrants coming to Europe.
Though Barçın Yinaç, a columnist on Turkey's oldest English-language newspaper, Hürriyet Daily News, says President Erdogan's increasingly authoritarian style of government has made the country's prospects of EU membership remoter than ever.
We in Turkey have lived through so many crises with the West. We will have a period of tension, there will be a war of words, but then always an understanding was reached at the end of the day.
But she insists Turkey needs NATO, and NATO needs Turkey, so we shouldn't panic about that just yet.
The BBC's Mike Thompson reporting there in Istanbul. Coming up later in the show, we'll look at the imprint of Erdogan's 13 years in power on Turkey's secular democracy. Okay, we've all had travel plans change at the last minute. Flights get canceled, people get sick, things happen. Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg came to New York in September on a sailboat to address the United Nations. She had been planning to slowly make her way overland to the UN Climate Change Conference in Chile. She did not want to fly, too much carbon emissions. So when the conference was abruptly moved to Madrid, things got complicated. But thank goodness for YouTube celebrities.
I'm Elena, and this is Raleigh, and this is our home, La Vagabond. We've been sailing around the world for the last 5 years and have recently found ourselves...
Australians Riley Whitlam and Elena Carasu have more than a million YouTube subscribers. That's sure to go up now that they're giving Thunberg a ride to Spain. It is not an ideal time of the year to sail east across the Atlantic, but the multiple-week journey from Virginia will be carbon-free, and unlike the boat that Greta took to the U.S., this one has a working toilet. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Today is National Take a Hike Day. No, not as in get out of town, but rather in go on a hike. Get outside. The World's Bianca Hillier looked into some new research about the benefits of putting on your hiking boots.
Research has long shown that being in nature improves mental health, and a new study has put a dollar value on the improvement in well-being due to park visits.
We've adopted a conservative figure of $6 trillion.
Yes, that's trillion with a T. Ralph Buckley is a professor emeritus in ecotourism at Griffith University in Australia. Buckley and his team asked nearly 20,000 Australians about their mental health and how often they visit national parks.
We used a statistical technique to identify what proportion of their self-perceived well-being was due to park visits. It's about 2.5 or 3%.
Meaning 2.5 or 3% of your mental health is based on how often you go outside.
And you might say, well, that's very little, but actually that's about the same as the effect of income.
What he's saying is being outside has the same impact on your mental health as how much money you make. Buckley and his team calculated what's called the health services value for Australia's national parks, about $100 billion US. Then they figured out how much that would cost across the globe.
You can scale up by mental health factors, or you can scale up by population, you can scale up by GDP, you can scale up by number of park visits. Depending which of those factors we use, we get a different number. But even if we take the most conservative estimate, it's still a big number, you know, $6 trillion.
That's $6 trillion worldwide in additional mental health costs if there were no national parks.
Poor mental health has quite a range of economic costs. The most obvious ones are if you go to the doctor and you have treatment, then obviously that's a cost. But in addition, if you have a severe problem with your mental health, then people have to look after you. The two largest cost components are lost productivity at work and antisocial behavior, and that has a substantial cost to our entire economy.
Buckley says the $6 trillion figure is approximate, but, quote, that doesn't matter. Future studies will need to refine the number. In the meantime, he says nature-based therapies should be designed, insured, and prescribed more often. He says trails, visitor centers, toilets, and educational programs are investments with big payoffs.
If governments would allocate a little more money to the budgets of their parks agencies, they would reap considerable savings in the money they have to allocate for mental health.
Buckley hopes his team's findings will push governments to action. As for me, I'm taking action. I'm already out the door. Not exactly Yosemite, but much better just being outside, even in a city. For the world and from a four-way traffic light outside our studio in Boston, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Wow, I hope she took a jacket, because today in Boston, cold. Back indoors now. Let me tell you about Robert Levinson. He is the longest-held hostage in American history. He disappeared 12 years ago in Iran. Levinson is a retired FBI agent who became a private investigator. At the time he went missing, he was a contractor for the CIA. Levinson's son Daniel says it's been a long time since he's received any credible word about his father.
We received pictures of him in April 2011, and before that, a video of him in October 2010. That was the last proof of life we've had from him. We have not heard anything since.
But now Dan Levinson and his family are feeling more encouraged. The State Department is offering up to $20 million for information leading to Levinson's safe location, recovery, and return. That's in addition to a $5 million reward from the FBI. And for the first time, Iran has acknowledged that it had an ongoing case against Robert Levinson before its Revolutionary Court. Dan Levinson says that's a big deal.
We were encouraged the fact that they unprompted sent this message and said that he had a case ongoing in the Revolutionary Court.
So I'd like to go back to December of 2007. You and your mother visited Iran about 9 months after your father went missing to try and speak with officials there and kind of retrace your father's steps. What were you actually able to do on that trip?
Well, we did meet with officials. We met with the head of the Tehran police. We met with ministers from the foreign ministry. We didn't get much information, to be honest. And we were hoping to meet with the country's leaders. The officials we met with, they told us they didn't know anything. So it wasn't a very successful information trip as far as hearing from the government. I did end up going back afterwards, actually, in 2016. But I had similar results where we were kind of stonewalled.
In 2013, this is 6 years after your father went missing, it was revealed that he was working for the CIA, trying to find an informant who could provide good intelligence about Iran. Do you think that has affected kind of the vigor with which the CIA and the U.S. government has put behind freeing your father?
he was working for the government, and the U.S. should not leave any man behind. And yes, the CIA revelation made things, I'd say, more complicated, but it shouldn't slow anything down. If anything, it shows how important an asset, and this may be why the Iranians have been so reluctant to come forward with any information about it.
Have you and your family been satisfied with the CIA's efforts to find him?
We haven't worked so much with them. They're the CIA and they do their own thing. So I can't really respond to that. We know that the CIA are not going to be the ones who are going to be getting my dad home anyway. It's a government-to-government issue in a lot of ways. That's what we've been told many times over the years. It's a diplomatic route that's going to get him home as well.
Was there a point, Daniel, where you and your family just thought, we've got to take this into our own hands? We've got to make some noise. The government's not doing enough.
Plenty of times over the years. We are always pushing our government to do more. I think we're more encouraged with the efforts of this administration. President Obama had 8 years to get him out, and he didn't. During the Bush administration, we barely heard anything, and it was very difficult. So we're working very closely. Robert O'Brien, who is now the National Security Advisor, was previously the Special Envoy for Hostages. And we worked closely with him for a year and a half, and he's still in touch with us regularly, and he's been wonderful. Secretary Pompeo was very interested in my dad's case before. As a congressman, he had asked to meet with my mom and I back in 2016. And so we know how important this case is to them. So seeing people like that who have shown interest before they got to their current positions, and seeing the fact that they have this kind of access to the president now, is encouraging for us.
I mean, talking of pressure, I mean, as I understand it, your family is now suing Iran, charging them with your father's kidnapping. Where does that case stand?
We start the trial next month. My whole family will be in D.C. for that. And, you know, it's another way we're trying to keep the pressure on Iran and letting them know we're not going to go away and that they're going to have to deal with this. We're not going to let my dad's case drop at all. So we're always constantly thinking of new ways to keep the pressure on Iran. And this is definitely one of them.
12 years missing is a long time. I mean, you were 21 when your father disappeared. Not a kid, but a lot has happened. That's kind of a lifetime. How have you coped with your father's disappearance?
It's very difficult for our family. We've had 4 weddings now. There are 6 grandchildren my dad's never met. We know he would love to be there playing with his grandchildren. Whenever we have these family gatherings, it's just there's something missing and it's very difficult. We're all very close. There's 7 kids. But it still, you know, wears on all of us. And you see it with my mom. And, you know, I have my days where it's just incredibly frustrating and incredibly sad.
Daniel Levinson is the son of Robert Levinson, who went missing in Iran 12 years ago. Daniel, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The World. The impeachment story started in Ukraine, but people there are focused on other pressing news, like war with Russia.
Ukraine needs to rely on itself. Things in the U.S. are going to fluctuate, things are going to change, but the war in eastern Ukraine is not changing for the time being, so it needs to be self-reliant.
An update from our reporter in Kyiv, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX.
Сьогодні справа про імпічмент президента Сполучених Штатів Дональда Трампа переходить у
Вільям Тейлор, ancien chargé d'affaires à Kiev.
Американо Трамп 8
Donald Trump, Ambassador William Taylor, Ukraine, the whole world is watching the impeachment inquiry today. How is it landing in the country, though, at the center of all of this? The World's Daniel Offman is in Kyiv, Ukraine right now. He says, like the U.S., Ukraine is fixated on a phone call.
Basically, the element of the story that's most interesting to Ukrainians is the phone call, the phone conversation between President Donald Trump and Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky. And so, essentially, the question is, did Zelensky act the right way in the phone call or did he not? And the coverage is 100% based on which channel you watch. So the channels that are owned by pro-government, pro-Zelensky oligarchs are saying he did a great job. He said exactly what he needed to say in order to maintain that flow of U.S. military funding for Ukraine. I spoke to an independent media analyst. His name is Vadim Miskiy, and here's what he had to say.
If it's a favorable channel, everybody will say that, okay, Zelensky do everything good, and no worries, everything goes good, and role of Ukraine is okay, and nothing extraordinary happened.
Now, Zelensky's political opponents say that, no, he acted dishonorably, he should have stood up to Trump, and he shouldn't have went along with Trump's demands.
It's reflected the general attitude of political force and guys who stand behind the political forces and some channels towards Zelensky, nothing more.
So depending on what newspaper, what channel you watch, you're going to get a different perspective. And Ukrainians, like in the streets of Kyiv, what are they saying about the impeachment inquiry?
For most Ukrainians, this actually isn't the top story. For them, there are a lot of much more vital, much more pertinent issues that affect them day to day. For example, the war in the East is still going on, and people think and talk about that all the time. People have family members, friends, loved ones who serve in the East, and they're worried about them every day, so that's at the top of mind. The other thing is that they are looking at the Zelensky government, and they're looking at his agenda because of the fact that he's the president, and his party also controls parliament. So with every new move, they're tracking that, and stuff that's going on far away in the United States just isn't as important.
So, Daniel, beyond how the impeachment inquiry is covered in the media, really at the core of this is that infamous phone call between Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine. And at the core of that phone call is nearly $400 million in military aid that was being held up allegedly in exchange for dirt on Joe Biden. So according to the people you spoke with, has anything changed about their view of U.S. support there in Ukraine?
Well, actually, I spoke to an independent military analyst. His name is Mikhail Losamos. He actually looked at the U.S.-Ukrainian relationship very realistically. He said, listen, the U.S. right now is going through a political crisis. It's going through an election season, and stuff will change.
And, of course, Ukraine needs to do as Ukraine needs to do in this situation on the war, in the conditions of the war with Russia.
He said that Ukraine needs to rely on itself. It needs to rely on its own military and to build it internally. And the fact is, things in the U.S. will fluctuate politically, but the war in eastern Ukraine is not changing for the time being, so it needs to be self-reliant. Another interesting point that he brought up was the fact that the U.S. withdrew from Syria and abandoned the Kurds only underlined that point. So if I'm a Ukrainian sitting here in Kyiv, why should I rely on the Americans if they have shown that at times they're just not trustworthy?
The U.S. military does have a presence in Ukraine. Have you been able to speak with any of their people, and what are they saying?
Yes, the U.S. military does have a presence here in Ukraine. Of course, it's not a combat mission here in Ukraine, but they do have bases here in Ukraine in which they train with their Ukrainian military counterparts. I actually visited one of those bases in western Ukraine, and I was able to speak to some military personnel. And what's really interesting to me is they are living in a world in which impeachment doesn't exist, politics don't exist, the phone call between Trump and Zelensky never happens. They're there just to complete their mission, and their mission is to train with Ukrainian military personnel in order to advance their capabilities. When I spoke to them about that, I said, well, at the end of the day, you're here to train the Ukrainian military in order to retain its sovereignty and be able to keep up their military effort in the East against Russia. The word Russia was out of bounds. Anything veering on political, anything veering on the word Trump, impeachment was completely out of bounds. They're 100% focused just on their mission.
The World's Daniel Hoffman in Kyiv. Thanks very much for the view from there.
Thank you so much, Marco.
Okay, let's get back to the other big news from Washington today, Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's meeting with President Trump at the White House. Relations between the two countries have threatened to go off the rails in recent months, but so far Erdogan has managed to navigate the crisis. Soner Çoptay says it's because he is a masterful tactician. Çoptay is the author of Erdogan's Empire, Turkey and the Politics of the Middle East. I asked him how Erdogan got his start and managed to transform Turkey from a liberal secular democracy into a more religious conservative state.
Erdogan is a politician who comes from the other side of the tracks. He has long identified with Turkey's pious masses who in 20th century Turkey felt othered. People like Erdogan who wanted to wear religion on their sleeve in this ideologically secularist state established by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk felt that they did not have a fair share of the pie, and Erdogan was advocating for larger role for these groups in Turkish public. And he was also not shy about using Islam in politics. That put him on a trajectory of conflict with Turkey's secularist constitution and court, which actually sentenced him to jail. He served a short term that cast him as a hero in the eyes of his adoring supporters.
In 2003, when Erdogan first became prime minister, he sounded more like a liberal, didn't he? So how do you understand his transformation and how he changed Turkey?
When he first came to power, Erdogan indeed stood for Turkey's dispossessed masses. He had this image as the underdog. Erdogan also delivered quite phenomenal economic growth that he used to lift many of his supporters out of poverty. When Erdogan came to power, infant mortality rate in Turkey was comparable to pre-war Syria. Now, infant mortality rate is comparable to Spain, which is why he wins. But the same popularity that he built has also made him less and less of a liberal. And what happened is quite ironic. In the 20th century, Turkey was a country that treated people such as Erdogan, who wanted to wear religion on their sleeve, as second-class citizens. Now, in Erdogan's Turkey, Turkey treats people who don't want to wear religion on their sleeve as second-class citizens. He's turned the tables upside down. So his trajectory, I argue, has thrown Turkey into a deep political crisis where half of the country supports him and the other half loathes him.
So, Nera, I know you've been quoted in the past as describing Erdogan as a doner kebab master. That would be that sliced meat on a pita all over the world in Turkish-style delis. What do you mean by that?
It's meat on a spit. The master takes really thin slices from the spit, almost paper-thin slices with his sharp knife. And if you don't watch the spit, you really don't see it get small. So I argue that Erdogan's undermining of Turkey's democratic institutions is not a product of the last few years. In fact, he's been doing this for a very long time. He was very meticulous in terms of going after his opponents, cracking down on dissidents, locking up dissidents as early as the end of the last decade. But because he was very gradualist about this, with the precision of a doner kebab master, taking really thin slices from his opposition, not going on massive crackdowns, that did not fall into the radar screen of broader global audiences.
So, Nair, today we have some pretty striking optics. Erdogan is at the White House despite a crisis in Turkish-U.S. relations. Do you see the bromance on display right now between Trump and Erdogan? And is it enough to keep the Turkish-U.S. alliance intact?
I do see an affinity between the two leaders. Erdogan and Trump, I think, have a political man crush on each other. They like each other's style of governance. But there are so many issues that divide Turkey and the United States, from Syria to Turkey's purchase of Russian-made missile defense system to Erdogan's democratic transgressions. But Trump has been able to hold off many of these pressures in the U.S. Capitol. He has prevented massive sanctions. The problem, of course, here is that you can't hinge a relationship between two countries on two leaders because that is just not enough to carry the relationship forward in the long term.
Finally, Soner, there are big risks that lie ahead for Erdogan. Just check them off. What are they?
I would say the biggest risk for Erdogan is his ability to leverage Putin and Trump against each other will be limited. And of course, the second problem is Turkey's constant paralysis between these two blocks that oppose Erdogan and that love Erdogan. And increasingly, there's no room left in between. I see Erdogan becoming only more authoritarian going forward. Left its own dynamics, Turkish society is going to vote him out. So that means he will only become more authoritarian to prevent that from happening, and that will only exacerbate Turkey's domestic political crisis.
Soner Çoptay, the author of Erdogan's Empire, Turkey and the Politics of the Middle East. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Marco. It was a pleasure.
We'll come back to it, but let's put a pin in the heavy news for the next few minutes. The Heptones, classic reggae from the 1970s, from Jamaica, but produced in Jamaica, Queens, the neighborhood in New York City, thanks to VP Records. VP stands for Vincent and Patricia Chin, the children of Chinese immigrants via Jamaica. In 1958, Vincent and Patricia opened Randy's Record Mart in Kingston before moving to New York in the 70s. The business has been kept up by their son, Chris Chin. When Chris was a kid in Kingston, the Heptones were his soundtrack. So was Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, and Burning Spear. Anyone who was part of the Jamaican music constellation, Chris met them. And as head of VP Records today, Chris continues to be in that world, even as reggae shifts to dancehall rhythms.
Just being in the store, it was a very busy part of Kingston, so there's a lot of buses and traffic and, you know, we're thriving and really, really the hub of the music industry.
Yeah, I was reading that by 1962, your parents had converted the upper floor of the record store into a recording studio, and Bob Marley and Peter Tosh, Burning Spear, all recorded there. I mean, I know you were pretty young, but were you too young to form any memories of those sessions?
I remember, like, when Burning Spear was recording that album, the Marcus Garvey album, and Spear, Dirty Harry, a lot of the musicians were, you know, always at the studio and in the store. So, you know, it was kind of, that's my memory of, and I remember seeing Bob there and Peter there on a few occasions.
Yeah, how did they strike you? I mean, you must have been like 4 or 5 at the time.
Yes, but, you know, I guess growing up from a very young age, it just seemed like the norm to be cliche, but it seemed like the norm. It wasn't anything, you know, really, really different, you know.
Yeah, just another day at Randy's Record Mart with Bob Marley and Peter Tosh hanging out. Yeah, eventually, your parents left Jamaica. They set up shop in Queens in New York. Why did they make that move?
The political climate, there's a lot of changes in the country. You know, my dad decided to have maybe a second home. So he had set up shop in New York.
Set up shop in New York in Jamaica, Queens, on Jamaica Avenue. Was that intentional, or did your parents feel like they had any choice in the matter?
Well, you know, at the time, my uncle had a record store in Brooklyn. So because of that, he decided to set up shop in Queens. But just ironically, he chose Jamaica. Mm. And that, at the time, was a very diverse neighborhood. So, I mean, it all worked out good.
Every time I hear the music and I make a dip, a dip.
Music is always very important to Jamaicans. You know, it's a big part of the culture. So as it evolves, we just adapt to it. There are different styles, and there still exist different styles of traditional reggae, dancehall, lovers rock. And they still coexist. I mean, you know, different people like different flavors. And, you know, we just adapt to it and move with the changes, to be honest with you. You know?
That is the only thing I need. I don't intend right now just to lose my main squeeze. Oh, Guantanamela, you a killer. Girl, you watch you want to have me body under pressure. Man, see your body, I'll kill my sitter. When your body right, just to know you got the power. But
Chris Chin, let me get back to your parents one more time, Vincent and Patricia. Why did they open that first record store, Randy's Record Mart in Kingston, to begin with? I mean, did they just naturally gravitate to sounds like ska and reggae?
It started from a very humble beginning that my mom and dad set up this, technically we'd call it a used record store. And then it grew from there. My mom went out and she purchased records, and my dad would travel abroad and bring back records. And it just, you know, grew from then. They were very entrepreneurial, and they just started it that way.
When the roll is called, I'll be standing taller to face the darkest and the hardest of time.
A new box set celebrates VP Records' 40 years in business. That was Chris Chin telling us about the record company his parents created out of a record store in 1950s Kingston, Jamaica, VP Records.
You can call me by my name, I am ready to roll. Once the rules remain the same, how the story's been told. Call me anytime, never cop out. Lioness is on the rise, don't you ever have doubt.
Venice is a city of canals built on a lagoon, so it's known for water, but not this much. Record flooding has inundated piazzas, landmarks, and hotels. Cafe chairs and tables are floating down streets.
It was incredible.
Marco Sognacci drives a water taxi. We spoke with him by phone. He was plying his boat through a canal today. He says Venice has had a record high tide, more than 6 feet.
We had a special high tide
1.87 meters. The last very high day was in 1966. And the wind was very strong, 120 kilometers per hour.
Sognacci says the tide was so high that boats couldn't pass under bridges.
A little disaster, a big disaster.
Hello?
Sognacci passed the phone to passenger Charlene Waller of Oxford, England. She had been trying to get to the airport on a larger boat, a Vaporetto.
We're on the water taxi now because the Vaporetto stop was closed. There was some damage at the stop. I did see a lot of people using their water pumps or brooms or buckets and just brushing the water, pushing the water outside, out of the house, back into the canals. So you really couldn't go anywhere unless you had high enough water boots.
The mayor of Venice, Luigi Brugnaro, has declared a state of emergency. Yeah, Venice has been underwater before. Its iconic St. Mark's Basilica has flooded 6 times in the past millennium, but 4 of those times happened in the past 2 decades. The mayor blames this on climate change. A multi-billion-dollar project in Venice to hold back the tides has been in the works for more than 30 years, but it's still not finished. The mayor promises it'll be completed soon. For now, though, Marco Sognacci, the water taxi driver, he's bracing for even more flooding in the days to come. And now let's return to the top story this Wednesday, the long day of impeachment hearings. The World's Matthew Bell has been on it since the witnesses arrived on Capitol Hill and joins us now to talk about the biggest revelations and most important takeaways. Matthew, what did we learn new from the hearings today?
The story's been with us for weeks, but I got to say that it feels like something different today. It feels like Congress flipped a switch. We have formal hearings live, real time in front of us. It feels like the start of something else, a new chapter. As for what we learned that's new, it's about a phone call. This was a different phone call than the one on July 25th between Trump and Zelensky. It was between Trump's EU ambassador, Gordon Sondland, and Donald Trump himself. And William Taylor explained today, he testified, was at the U.S. Embassy in the Ukrainian capital. He was one of the two lead witnesses in today's hearings. He said he described the call that was overheard by a member of his staff.
At a restaurant, Ambassador Sondland called President Trump and told him of his meetings in Kyiv. The member of my staff could hear President Trump on the phone asking Ambassador Sondland about the investigations. Ambassador Sondland told President Trump the Ukrainians were ready to move forward. Following the call with President Trump, the member of my staff asked Ambassador Sondland what President Trump thought about Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland responded that President Trump cares more about the investigations of Biden, which Giuliani was pressing for.
So if Donald Trump was talking with Ambassador Gordon Sondland about an investigation of Biden, why is that significant?
This makes a direct connection between Trump and the pressure campaign on Ukraine's president to open up investigations into two things, the 2016 election here in the U.S. and the Bidens. That campaign, of course, was led by White House lawyer Rudy Giuliani. He was Trump's point man running this sort of shadow foreign policy in Ukraine. And that is the bottom line of the narrative that Democrats were focusing on today. In addition to Taylor, George Kent, he's another State Department diplomat who worked on Ukraine, appeared today. Both of them, both Taylor and Kent, talked through in granular detail about how they came to understand how Trump and Giuliani were pushing Ukraine's government on this stuff. They said they were troubled by what was going on. At one point, the Democrats' lawyer, Dan Goldman, asked William Taylor this question.
Ambassador Taylor, in your decades of military service and diplomatic service representing the United States around the world, have you ever seen another example of foreign aid conditioned on the personal or political interests of the President of the United States?
No, Mr. Goldman, I have not.
So, Matthew, the Democrats are seeing President Trump inappropriately putting pressure on the Ukrainian government for Trump's own personal and political reasons. Let's get into the Republican line of questioning on this today. What did they focus on?
Ranking Member Devin Nunes today called the whole process, quote, a low-rent Ukrainian sequel to the Russian hoax. Nunes suggested that the Democrats might have been in cahoots, even with the whistleblower who sparked this whole process. He continued also to push a debunked conspiracy theory that it was Ukraine and not Russia, as U.S. intelligence agencies say, that interfered in the 2016 election. Nunes also said it made sense that Trump would be calling for an investigation into meddling by Ukraine.
The Democrats downplay, ignore, or outright deny the many indications that Ukrainians actually did meddle in the election. A shocking about-face for people who for 3 years argued that foreign election meddling was an intolerable crime that threatened the heart of our democracy.
So what else did we hear from these two witnesses, Matthew, who are both experienced diplomats with many years of service in Ukraine? And we should point out, for a long time, there was solid bipartisan agreement about helping Ukraine, right?
A big point that both Taylor and Kent wanted to make was about how U.S. military assistance has been critical for a country like Ukraine, because this is a place where, as Taylor said, this is Russian troops are inside the borders of Ukraine and Ukrainian soldiers are getting killed one or two a week. Taylor was at the front lines just last week where Ukrainian troops died in battle. He talked about being worried that Ukraine is getting caught up in this American political fight and is going to end up being the big loser. He's, you know, this was kind of the bottom line of what he had to say about why he had so many problems with the Trump-Giuliani line of policy in Ukraine.
More witnesses to come. The World's Matthew Bell, thanks for staying on the case.
Thank you.
There are other stories in the world today besides impeachment, like way out of this world. The most distant world ever explored, about 4 billion miles away from Earth, has just been given a name, Arrokoth. That means sky in the language of the Powhatan people, indigenous North Americans who originally inhabited eastern Virginia. The Hubble Space Telescope, which first discovered the distant world back in 2014, is operated from Baltimore. That's near the ancestral home of the Powhatan. Arrokoth is shaped like a snowman, which seems appropriate given that it is covered in ice. The word Arrokoth that reflects the inspiration of looking up to the skies, wondering about worlds beyond our own. And that is where we leave things today from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Should I say it? Yeah, why not? Keep your feet on the ground and keep reaching for the stars. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.